Welcome. You are listening to a recording provided for the use of those who are blind and or print impaired. Materials or items read on the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service, or AIRS LA, are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Welcome to episode 305 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening program developed for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host and producer, and I look forward to sharing with you over the next 40 minutes updates to our local garden scene and recent articles about gardens, plants, and designers, both in California and around the world. Gardens are in my DNA. I was raised in a family of gardeners, and my grandparents and mother handed down a love of flowers, of orchids, and of roses, among many other gifts. I have been an inveterate gardener for years, from that first six-pack of marigolds I bought at Home Depot in suburban Connecticut to laying out birthday rose gardens, planting fruit trees, and rescuing overgrown and underloved gardens, as well as building my own garden library with classic design texts, memoirs, and commentaries from gardeners and designers alike, and, well, just a few glossy coffee table indulgences. I've spent years getting to know California's Mediterranean garden landscapes, plants, and climate, even as I have fallen for English and continental garden design traditions, grown fond of the particularities and peculiarities of succulents, which perform so well in our climate, and learned to love and respect the quiet power of a Japanese garden. I have been active in local garden societies and visited botanical gardens around the world, believing not only in the benefits of gardening itself, but of being in the garden, and of being charmed by that special alchemy of plants, climate, soil, design, place, space, light, and shade. Gardens are a place where we can become more alive and more connected with the world we share with others. And as the good book reminds us, it all began in a garden. Welcome to this week's show. After last week's litany of classes and sessions to increase your horticultural skill and knowledge, we turn this week to several insights about how to fix, address, and invest in certain spaces. We start with Robin Lane Fox's recent column published on the 8th of August, What Really Counts as Butterfly-Friendly Planting. For more species to stay put rather than fly south, we need to give them a year-round garden habitat, not just a summer resort. Last year was awful for butterflies in Britain. The rain, the cloud, the muted summer caused the counts of most of them to drop alarmingly. This year's long dry run is helping them to pick up. At the micro level, I have been trying to help. In 2023, I was deputed to develop a butterfly-friendly planting along a sunny bank, about 250 yards long, which belonged to my Oxford college. The public buzz around wildflowers had not passed my colleagues by. For decades, we have had areas of grass within the walls that are not mown until early June. They are underplanted with spring bulbs and left uncut until the cow parsley has flowered and the narcissi die down. Beyond them, the other lawns are mown as green carpets to set off the formal garden. They are sat on by college members who chat, kiss, and picnic there. Every 3 years, they have to host a massive ball for 1,500 guests. None of these activities goes well with unmown grass and yet more insects. Lawns have become hotspots for apostles of wilding, but they are not the only candidates for change. Other areas of mown grass are bigger. Playing field. There, users' enthusiasm disappears. Even the keenest wildflowers find it hard to impose no-mow May on a golf course or a football pitch. Nonetheless, level playing fields tend to have rough perimeters. Our college playing field is bounded on one side by a river and on another, in part, by a thorny hedge. A south-facing bank slopes beneath it, beyond the cricketing boundary. Why not plant it for butterflies and give them a grandstand view of the sport? Butterfly gardening is a big subject. the best simple book on it remains The Butterfly Gardener by expert practitioners Miriam Rothschild and Clive Farrell, published in 1983. I set about planning our bank with two of their principles in mind. One is the distinction between natives and migrants. The other is the need to maintain a population, not extend a welcome for only a month. I have had expert advice to hand. One of my Oxford colleagues is Jeremy Thomas, emeritus professor of ecology, who knows what butterflies really want. Among his distinctions is his reestablishment of the large blue butterfly on open land in Dorset, where it now breeds and persists. In the hedge behind our bank, he began by finding black and brown hairstreak butterflies. Having overlooked them, I now aim to make them multiply. In gardens, onlookers ignore the line between natives and migrants. Red admirals on buddleias or painted ladies on Michaelmas daisies are high points in urban gardeners' autumn viewing. They may seem to justify gardens as safe spaces for dwindling butterflies, reversing their decline on farmland. However, these butterflies and many others are migrants. They fly in by the 10,000s at heights that are beyond our vigilant eyes. After sunning themselves on pretty plants in late summer, they fly off south. Most of them do not breed and overwinter in Britain. Yellow brimstones, hairstreaks, or orange tips are different. Unlike painted ladies and other winged non-doms, they spend the whole year in Britain and need food, plants, and shelter in which to breed and survive. Our bank is to be a habitat, not a summer resort. To be a success, it has to look a mess. Over in Cambridge, our sister college, King's College, has wilded with a different emphasis. It has a bold use of wild flowers that is highly photogenic. In 2019-20, on the big lawn between the chapel and the river beyond, the college gardeners killed off the grass with glyphosate, sacrificed the bare surface, and then sowed it with wild flowers. Their aim was to evoke the flowery meadows of a previous generation. For a few weeks in summer, the scarlet poppies, white oxeye daisies, blue cornflowers, and so forth show a waving mass of flowers. Then they go brown, die off, and have to be mown, usually in August. This job is done by two shire horses pulling an old-fashioned cart, much to spectators' delight. I am not going down this nostalgic route. Horse-drawn scythes could not cut our bank, and there is doublethink on this use of them. One of King's declared aims is to save carbon by not using a petrol-driven tractor, but the horses are brought to and fro in a horsebox from stables about 26 miles away. Fuel-powered mowing up and down their meadow would surely give off less carbon. As for impacting the ground, a motorized scythe on rubber wheels, steered by a gardener on foot, does no such damage, a reason why gardeners like to use one. Over time, King's plan is to establish perennial plants in its pseudo-meadow, too. In Oxford, our bank, as a habitat, will major on perennial cover from the start. Like the King's gardeners, we killed off the grass, ours being rough, not fine turf, with glyphosate last autumn. Then we forked and raked the slope by hand. Instead of seeds at risk to a dry spring, I opted for plug plants, ready-grown for instant planting. They were a happy choice. If we had sown seeds, they would not have germinated in the long dry spell. Thomas set out a basic list of species, whereupon I turned to Landlife Wildflowers in Lincolnshire, experienced suppliers of native-grown plugs. One by one, hundreds were trialed in by hand just as the weather was becoming dry. Ladies' bedstraw, bird's foot trefoil, meadow geranium, meadow scabiosus, primroses, cowslips, and knapweed were mixed with yarrow, a foe in the main college lawns. Yellow rattle will prevent strong grass from returning, but I stop short of clover, a pest if it infests a cricket wicket. For native butterflies, we retain green ivy and some patches of stinging nettles. Next year, I will let some hops run into the hedge, relished by comma butterflies and small tortoise shells. For orange tips, young plants of mustard garlic are even easier to establish than ladies' smock, the other favorite. For brimstones, bushes of buckthorn, Rhamnus cathartica, are the crucial hosts. Above this Oxford mess, I put in some non-native candy, plants whose flowers attract summer butterflies, whether migrants or not. The star here is the tall Verbena bonaerensis from Buenos Aires. It is not always hardy, but its stems are 3 feet high with heads of lavender mauve flowers. During the hard days of spring planting, I saw no butterflies at all. The only hair streaks on view were pink ones, tinted in the hair of our Brazilian co-worker, Arturo. For 14 weeks, we had to water from a dripping hose, stretched laboriously from a distant pavilion's tap. Thistles regenerated quickly and were pulled out, but almost all of the plug plants have survived. On our native mix, I note meadow browns, large and small whites, and the occasional comma. On our tall foreign verbenas, I see peacocks, red admirals, small tortoise shells, and much else. Like diners out, butterflies like foreign cuisine. We must wait till next year to see how many have overwintered in our buckthorn and ivy. At least they will not have done a bunk to Cambridge, seduced by a showy short-term offer. The most recent column by Robin Lane Fox, published on the 8th of August, What Really Counts as Butterfly-Friendly Planting. We turn next to an article by Rosie Patterson, published in Country Life magazine on the 4th of August. The grass isn't always greener on the other side. Five alternatives to lawn, from fleshy sedums to aromatic thyme. No Mo May and similar initiatives want to inspire gardeners to replace their lawns with pollinator-friendly alternatives, but knowing where to start and what to do is an oft-putting minefield. Earlier this week, Country Life reported that King's College, Cambridge, has replaced its once extensively manicured turf with a lush, majestic meadow. The carpet of poppies, cornflowers, and oxeye daisies, which stretches from the college chapel to the River Cam, first flourished in 2020, after 3 years of sowing and maintenance. The impact on biodiversity has been astonishing, but bat numbers in the college gardens have increased threefold and invertebrates by 25 times. But, oh my, do we all underestimate the work a wildflower meadow requires in order for it to take hold and succeed? Firstly, you need patience, because it can take years to convert a lawn into a well-balanced mix of grass and wildflowers. Secondly, you need the right kind of soil, well-drained and low in nutrients. This may entail scraping off the layer of topsoil that allows grass to flourish and overwhelm everything. Thirdly, you will need to ensure that your wildflower meadow-to-be is in full sun. If we've already put you off, you'll be happy to hear that there are other, sometimes less laborious, alternatives to having a lawn. After all, lawns have taken plenty of flack for being what detractors call a biodiversity desert in recent years. Some are more transformative than others, but the single most important thing to remember is that you don't have to do away with every inch of lawn altogether. Mix and match. Embrace something more manicured in one area of the garden and leave other bits to grow up and blend into the landscape. Or let it all grow up and then mow paths and areas to sit, eat, and play in. Your garden is your oyster, so without further ado, here are five ideas that will hopefully inspire your next green-fingered adventure. Gravel. You can construct a gravel garden in any sort of area, but the plants themselves, typically Mediterranean, favor sandy, well-drained soil with low fertility levels. The majority of garden designers agree that the single most important step is to blitz all perennial weeds. Once that's done, you'll need to decide on the type of gravel you want to use. The RHS recommends trying to match it to the color of any existing paving and stone structures, and whether or not you require plants to self-seed. If you don't, you can go in with an underlayer of landscape fabric, a textile material designed to inhibit the growth of weeds. Creeping thyme. Creeping thyme is a dwarf aromatic shrub with very small, pointy, dark green leaves, and in the summer, clusters of purple flowers. It does well in full sun and can survive for up to 10 years in an exposed or sheltered spot. It is also drought resistant and therefore requires minimal watering. You can opt for a full creeping thyme lawn. It's great ground cover, but works best on smaller areas, or restrict its use to in between paving stones or wooden steps so that the scent is released and wafts slowly upwards as you walk. The downside? It can be costly endeavor because the thyme has to be bought as plants. Clover. There is plenty to praise clover, a member of the pea family, for. Most importantly, it's a valuable source of nectar for bees, and as it can cope with some foot traffic, clover makes an excellent alternative to lawn grass species, particularly on poor dry soils. Some gardeners have fully embraced the benefits of clover and have reseeded lawns with white clover using dwarf agricultural cultivars or strains such as Kent Wild White. Clover lawns are far more sustainable and environmentally friendly alternative to labor and resource-intensive fine lawns. It also helpfully produces its own nitrogen, so it doesn't need fertilizer to keep it looking green and healthy. Instead of going the whole hog, you can let clover establish in lone clumps on an otherwise neat lawn. Alternatively, use a combination of clover and grasses so that when the clover goes dormant in winter, you don't end up with too much exposed soil. Sedums. Let's start by admitting that sedum matting won't be for everyone, chiefly because the plants are much more delicate than lawn and won't cope with heavy, frequent foot traffic. The upside is that the effect, preferably on a front garden or sloping lawn, is visually arresting, a patchwork of fleshy textures that are kind to the environment and a magnet for two pollinating insects. Top tips include removing any existing ground cover and grass from the site, tilling to a depth of 15 centimeters and watering plants weekly for the first month. Once established, they're reliably drought-tolerant. Wildflowers. Country Life columnist Alan Titchmarsh's own 2-acre wildflower meadow was a decade in the making, though it now requires little to no maintenance. He recommends sowing in October, as the seed will be vernalized. Our garden editor, Tiffany Danoff, says to sow yellow rattle alongside your chosen seed mix because it will predate on any pesky grass that tries to stage a comeback. The Plant Life website contains even more handy tips and tricks, such as controlling any problem plants that could prevent your meadow from thriving: nettle, creeping thistle, dock, bramble, and scrub, and mowing your meadow area after plants have finished flowering and set seed, and again at the end of winter. Finally, Lindum Turf produces ready-to-roll wildflower turf, featuring a careful, balanced blend of native wildflowers, herbs, and perennials planted at optimum density for the best possible results. An article by Rosie Patterson, published on the 4th of August in Country Life magazine, "The Grass Isn't Always Greener on the Other Side: 5 Alternatives to Lawn from Fleshy Sedums to Aromatic Thyme." Turn next to an article by Francesca Peacock, published in the Financial Times of London on the 10th of August, "How to Transform a Balcony into a Planted Paradise. Even the tiniest spaces offer opportunities for greener living." Writing in 1950, Vita Sackville-West declared a small garden to be anything from 0.5 acre to 2 acres. Though it may seem inconceivable for someone who gardened on the scale of Sissinghurst, many keen gardeners in cities have to make do with far less than 0.5 acre, a tiny terrace, a small balcony, or a pair of window boxes. Yet limited space does not mean limited opportunity. Even the smallest outdoor area can be a source of joy. One gardener who has made the most of his balcony space is Oliver Hymans, a finalist for the Gardener's World Gardens of the Year in 2023, transformed the balcony of his low-rise flat in northeast London from an unloved storage space into a green paradise. Making the most of its south-facing aspect, he has used every inch of space. A pelargonium theater on the wall adds height, while window boxes and planters blur the edges, adding an infinity pool to effect to the greenery. Despite it being just 5 by 1.5 meters, the sheer profusion of plants and colors make the space feel as bold and inspiring as many larger gardens. Hymans grows a mixture of plants that like the balcony's heat, annuals such as poppies, cosmos, and cow parsley. There are challenges that come with creating a garden suspended above ground. His balcony has no tap and is not fully open to the rain, but he stresses the benefits. Being able to step out into our little patch of greenery makes everything worth it. It's that connection with the outdoors that makes city living work for us. The balcony has transformed the rest of the flat, with the door staying open every day of the warmer months. Author and podcaster Alice Vincent discovered a love of gardening through her own balcony space, which she called the treehouse, and is about which she wrote in her book Rootbound, Rewilding a Life. A self-taught expert in balcony gardens, she says that they offer the perfect playground for gardeners who are new to gardening. In a small space and often with a lot of light, the natural challenges provided by containers and lugging soil up endless flights of stairs become opportunities. In these tiny gardens, there is no need to deal with any older plants left behind by previous owners. There are often fewer weeds and invasive species, and smaller plants can have an outsized effect. Gardening on a balcony can be economical, says Vincent, and also beneficial to the local urban environment. Any home buyer wanting to recreate Hymans' success in the capital might be tempted by this 3-bedroom flat in Battersea, which is currently on the market for £1.525 million. It has a small third-floor balcony that leads off from the sitting room, providing the opportunity to create a garden overlooking Battersea Park in a way of bringing the green space even closer to the flat. This 4-bedroom flat in South Kensington, priced at £3.65 million, has a portico balcony just beyond the floor-to-ceiling French doors in the reception room. Visible from the sitting room, a planted balcony would provide an extra screen from the road below. It is perhaps no surprise that since 2021, there has been a balcony category at the RHS Chelsea Flower Show. The category, which asks designers to create a capsule garden in a space of 5 by 2 meters, began, in Vincent's words, as a nod to the millennials, who might have smaller homes and less time to spend gardening, but also value well-being and a connection with nature. It's now an annual fixture and a judge component of the show. The winner of this year's competition included a garden that managed to bring the wonders of a Japanese forest to a small space, an evergreen courtyard designed to be restorative for carers, and a coastal-inspired balcony that demonstrated how water features can be integral to even the most diminutive of outdoor areas. All of this year's entries showcased clever planting solutions, containers and beds with year-round interest, plants for pollinators to give an urban area an environmental edge. These gardens show that balcony spaces can be just as creative and productive as larger plots and suited to city living. An article by Francesca Peacock, published in the Financial Times of London under their property listings section, How to Transform a Balcony into a Planted Paradise, was published on August 10th. Mindful of the fading days of summer, we turn next to an article published in Country Life magazine at the end of July by their garden columnist Isabel Bannerman. Gardens fade in the heat of high summer, but it's still possible to plant pockets of joy in shaded spaces. This is traditionally the time of powdery daisies caked in sun, but our writer craves a spritz more likely found among shade-loving plants in damp holding places. Summer came early this year, which means that the dog days will come sooner. Twilight signals respite, however, a dewy dropping away from the heat of the day, strengthening shadows with that peerless, exotic quality seen in John Singer Sargent's Girls with Lanterns and Lilies, Carnation, Lily, Lily Rose. Somehow he paints the warm cinnamon scent of carnations, Japanese lilies, golden rayed and stargazing oriental lilies. There are still scrambling roses, the Rosa Moscata autumnalis princess of Nassau, and the chic white dishes of Rosa Paul's perpetual white, making a cooler garden in the gloaming, ghostly like Miss Wilmot's sea holly. But the best things in the thickening dusk are scented. This is traditionally the time of powdery daisies caked in sun, Shasta, Aster, Rudbeckia, Helenium, and Helianthus. Yet what I crave is a freshening up, a spritz more likely found among shade lovers in damp holding places, starched and crumpled violet and white. This is where the perennial pea twines with its pale snail of satin, elevating the whole with the plant equivalent of fireflies. I need fleece and feather boas, white and amethyst, astilbe arensii, but it's probably too late. The gauzy stuff is harder to find in high summer. Phlox gather with the trumpets of wood tobacco, Nicotiana sylvestris, Nicotianas affinis, and Nicotiana suaveolens from Australia, peering out of the gloom shyly, perfuming the still night. Of phlox paniculata, with their satin-scented softness, smelling of boudoirs, David is my top choice, although Mount Fuji and Monica Lindenbell come close. These form the beating heart of the Après Rose Garden. One could add to these a late pale shrub rose, Souvenir de la Malmaison, or David Austin's Desdemona, perhaps. But it is the Phalictrum Splendide White that has proved key to leavening this heady assembly. Shamrock-shaped leaves stay low, and nebulas of tiny dancing pearl drops reach up, piercing the surrounding verbiage like crystal candelabra. I fell in love with phlox in Cornwall, where it was wet and cool enough for them never to get mildewed. Here in Somerset, where it rains markedly less, they need shade more than half the day and moisture aplenty in the soil, so lots of mulch and compost. The quest is for tall, wandy things, such as the spires of Veronicastrum virginicum album, Erica, or V. virginicum F. rosea, and behind them, Actaea simplex Pritchard's giant, the bugbane, which I only clocked when going around John Massey's garden at Ashwood Nurseries in West Midlands in late summer, where it seemed to float in the air above our heads, exuding an almondy, candied smell. Bugbane goes at the back with Cephalaria gigantea, or in the middle ground, starred with the shorter Scaviosa columbaria subspecies Ochrelucra, the okra pincushions of which are no trouble to grow. I have seen them wild on the verges of Oxfordshire, together with chicory. I have a thing about chicory, Chicorium intibus, and so thistle, Cicerbita plumieri, both something like a tall blue dandelion. The hairless blue sow whistle was recommended by E.A. Bowles for sitting tight as a broody hen before throwing up a spire of 7-foot blue lavender blooms. No staking required. It's been a protected species since the 1970s, but seed can be had from Plant World Seeds as Lactuca plumieri. Bowles admitted to a great addiction to mallows, especially hollyhocks. I would say the singles, please, for like him, we are less fond of ear-wiggy doubles. All the mellows perform now. Hibiscus, Lavatera, and especially the Alcathea sufrutensis Park Alley and Palest Chamois. This is a perennial branching cross between the Alcea, the hollyhock, and Althea, the marshmallow, but supply is elusive. Poke in among them Gladiolus muriellae, treated as an annual, Orchideceus in look and smell, and possibly spidery Cleome spinosa of any hue, although their sweaty guava cannabis smell verges on the stinky. Umbels like the Selenium waliacanum, Himalayan cow parsley, like these conditions. Once asked, why do we need Himalayan cow parsley? By a querulous visitor, I was dumbfounded. Answer was obvious, because it flowers 2 months later, in July. Wild-looking Clematis reddariana can scramble through anything with waxy reflex blooms of a primrose color, but cowslip scented Clematis viticella, Caerulea luxurians, also called luxuriant blue, has the ink-stained quality of the spires of violet veronicastrum. There is a mutable lavender blue, found also in the petal backs of the new Swan series of boring but useful old Anemone japonica, flowering now. I see clouds of lavender blue, fireflies too, the evening star, and a glass or two. And I think to myself, an article by Isabel Bannerman, published in late July in Country Life magazine, gardens fade in the heat of high summer, but it's still possible to plant pockets of joy in shaded spaces. We close this week with another article published in Country Life magazine, this one by George Plumptree, published on the 3rd of August, The Rose That Flowers from October to Summer, and the Man Who Used It to Light Up a Beautiful Corner of London. George Plumptree pays tribute to the late Roger Phillips, whose seminal book on trees has been updated almost 50 years after its initial publication. It's a rare privilege for a gardening writer to have a new edition of a book published posthumously. Such luminaries include Gertrude Jekyll and Russell Page, and now Roger Phillips. His bestseller, Trees, has just had a revised edition released by Macmillan, which published the groundbreaking original in 1978. The book covers trees of North America, Europe, the UK, and Ireland, and has been expanded to cover 650 species from the original 500. As well as its comprehensiveness, it has all the other instantly recognizable hallmarks of Phillips' particular style that made this, and all the books he produced over a lifetime of writing about plants, so compelling. He had a way of combining simplicity of description with botanical authenticity, so a book such as Trees becomes more than an illustrated list. Because he was as good a photographer as he was a writer, the images, painstakingly detailed, contribute as much as the text. In particular, in the first section, the leaf key index, which Phillips pioneered. The sheer quantity of close detail is revealing of both the individual characteristics of different trees and the subtle variances within a family or genus. Trees, together with Phillips' other books, form a lasting legacy to this most engaging, erudite gardener and botanist who died in 2021. There is another living legacy to his talents, however, in the garden of Eccleston Square, London, which was his home for more than 40 years, and on which I am also fortunate enough to live. During his lifetime, he transformed the 3.5 acres from a dull city space into a garden teeming with interest. Taking advantage of the central London microclimate and the canopy of magnificent London plains, Plantanus ex Hispanica, he introduced a kaleidoscope of often exotic or rare plants of all shapes and sizes, from trees to small bulbs to perennials. There are a number of extensive collections, from ceanothus to camellias, at least one in flower every month of the year, and tree peonies, many of which produce flowers the size of dinner plates. There is also a good selection of the trees featured in Philip's book, but in the Eccleston Square setting, many have become most distinctive as hosts for a collection of climbing and rambling roses he planted, many of which have achieved prodigious size. Some are old favorites, such as an enormous plant of Rosa the Garland, which has formed a great canopy over a sturdy ironwood, Parotia persica. Others are less well known, such as Cooper's Burmese, or R. cooperi, which literally smothers a red apple, Acer rubrum, with its large, pure, white single flowers. Arguably, the real treasures are the tea and China roses, not least because they flower for months on end. The selection includes Rosa Alistair Stella Gray and a rose I had never heard of before, which is also my favorite because of its backstory. Rosa Generale Schnabelikene was bred in 1878 by the famous French rose beater Gilbert Nabonon. He named it after a Russian general and hero of the Crimean War who became a neighbor when he retired to Provence. One expert wrote of this rose, if a law was passed that one man should cultivate but one variety of rose, I should, without hesitation, choose Generale Schnabelikene. He goes on to say that it flowers continuously from October to summer, to which I can attest, as I photographed it flowering in Eccleston Square on Christmas Day 2024. As in his book Trees, the Eccleston Square garden is a testament to Philip's encyclopedic knowledge of plants built up over a lifetime of exploring and writing. He could have just as easily put together a companion volume on trees originating from other parts of the world, from China to Australasia, a particular favorite, and South America. I'll finish with a tree from the latter continent that is probably the rarest in the Eccleston Square garden. Lots of people in the UK grow Crinodendron hookerianum, with its distinctive bright red lantern flowers, but very few people grow its equally distinguished relative, C. patagua, with evergreen foliage that is scattered in midsummer with small, gorgeously delicate, creamy white lily-like flowers. Its healthy state in the heart of London is a worthy tribute to Philip's inspiring career as a gardener and author. This article originally appeared in the July 23rd issue of Country Life magazine and was written by George Plumptree, chief executive of the National Garden Scheme, for which the Eccleston Square Garden opens annually in May. The new edition of Trees is now out, published by Macmillan at £35. And that wraps up edition 305 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening program developed for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. Please send us your comments at www.lars.org or email us at one word, laradioreading@gmail.com. Give us suggestions of gardens or stories to follow, your thoughts on a favorite story you heard, or what you think of the broadcast itself. Gardens are not just plants, soil, and irrigation. They speak to us of the world around us, even as we try to create order and impose structure. They connect us to our landscape and to the cycles of nature. They teach us patience, stewardship, and fortitude. They offer possibilities of beauty and of persistence, sometimes even of transcendence. And they open our senses to both the heart and the soul, to being alive, to being connected with other gardeners, other gardens, and other times. Whether in a container or in pots on a balcony in the city, in a defined, dedicated garden area, planted around a suburban house or in an urban courtyard, or in spaces surrounded by trees, landscape, and open sky, gardens are precious indeed, no matter where they are. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host. Thanks for joining us. Until the next time.